I'm speaking today with State Senator Wendy Davis, who represents Senate District 10 up in Fort Worth. Senator Davis, thank you very much for talking to me today. You were elected in 2008, now gone through two regular sessions in the legislature, in the Senate. Has it been what you thought it would be when you first ran for office?
No. It's been much more challenging. The environment there has become so purely partisan, and the ideology has driven the agenda to a place that was, I don't think, expected by most people in Texas, and I don't think it's representative of most Texas families and what they want to see happening in the Capitol.
Now, I mean, the Senate itself has, you know, it's always been famous as, you know, this deliberate bipartisan body, but that's not kind of not been the case lately. There's been, the two-thirds rule, for example, doesn't mean what it used to mean, and with Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst possibly moving on to another position, there's going to be a big fight over who would replace him. When you look ahead at the next session, what is it you see? What's coming up?
Unfortunately, I think that it may even be worse in terms of the partisanship and the procedural trickery that's used to try to bypass our longstanding Senate traditions. And really, that's coming from primarily what we saw happen in the 2010 election cycle with the wave of more conservative Republican members being elected to the state house. It drove the agenda to a place of fear, quite honestly, for many Republicans, I think, who've been serving in the legislature for some time, who are naturally more moderate, but who felt compelled to move to the right out of fear that they, too, might see happen in their next election cycle what happened in 2010, that they might have an opponent run at them from the right, talk about the fact that they weren't representing a conservative enough ideology. And so as a consequence, literally, we watched the Capitol just shift dramatically to that place. Even senators in our Republican brethren who would say to us quietly, you know, this is wrong, we shouldn't be doing this, this is crazy, and yet they'd go to the floor and they would vote for all of the things that they knew really weren't taking Texas in the right direction. And in the most recent election cycle, of course, we have four senators who chose not to run for election again, all Republican, but all who came from a more historically moderate perspective and who brought a much more moderate voice to the table. And each of them was replaced by someone who's expressed a much more conservative ideology than the senator that was their predecessor. What I think that means is that we're going to see the Senate move even further to the right and be driven by an agenda that, again, isn't really representative of all of our families back home. It's much more representative of a very narrow special interest ideology that's kind of taken hold in the Capitol.
Let's look back on the two sessions that you've been in the Senate. What would you say have been your main accomplishments, the things you're most proud of in the two regular sessions you've been in the Senate?
Well, I have to say the thing I'm most proud of, although it didn't turn out as I would have liked, was taking the stand on the cuts to public education funding that I took. The filibuster that last day of the 82nd session was one of the scariest things I've ever done, honestly. And I've been involved in public life for quite some time. But I knew that it would certainly not earn me any popularity points with my brethren in the Capitol. I felt like it was important, though, and I think that our families back home are hoping that there will be people in the Capitol who will be willing to stand up and say, enough is enough, and not be afraid of what the political consequences of that might be. I'm also very proud. I feel like I've stood very strongly on behalf of real people, standing up against very strong special interests. Payday lenders is an example. The big insurance companies is an example. And really, I've been able to carve quite a place in terms of standing for women's issues. And I'm very, very proud to have brought that perspective to the table. I was especially pleased with passing the rape kit bill last session. That's going to, I hope, move us to clearing that backlog of multiple thousands of DNA
rape kits. We have a lot of that right here in Houston.
All over the state of Texas. So, you know, I feel like I've been sensitive to what my constituents sent me there to do, and I'm proud that I've maintained the integrity to continue to be their voice and honestly not to succumb to the powerful lobby pressures that exist there.
I mean, you talk about women's issues. I mean, in the last legislative session, there was a bit of a blow-up in the House side over some of your colleagues there believing they were not being treated respectfully. There was a formation of a legislative women's caucus that resulted from that. You know, more broadly, you know, since then we've seen, you know, what's been called a war on women going on, coming mostly out of Washington, D.C., but also out of state legislatures. You know, what does that mean to you? What's your view on that, and what needs to be done to push back on some of these things?
I've honestly been surprised by the agenda, because I think it's so out of touch with the reality of what women in this country value, not just Democratic women, Republican women as well. You know, the rights to make decisions about our own bodies, the intrusiveness of the transvaginal sonogram bill that passed in the Texas legislature this session is remarkable. And other states where it's been proposed, even dramatically Republican states, there's been such an uproar that it hasn't succeeded. And yet in Texas, it simply carried through without a great deal of that same sort of public understanding and dismay that I think is really present there, and I'm hopeful is going to evidence itself in future election cycles. But also the funding cuts for women's health care in general. Over 400,000 women in Texas lost their health care coverage, family planning, cancer screening services. And, of course, there was a direct attack on Planned Parenthood, even though the focus of that attack was not Planned Parenthood abortion services, which received no state or federal funding. Instead, it was the family care clinics that are doing those cancer screenings and the contraceptive services that are, really, honestly, helping us to be fiscally prudent in the state of Texas by preventing unwanted pregnancies and making sure that women have the right to control their own economic destinies and educational destinies in terms of their family planning. It really has been an assault, and I think a lot of women are really offended by the flagrant disregard for women's concerns in Texas. And it really has been replicated, all over the country. It's really remarkable to me that the GOP has gone down that road, and I think it's a dangerous road for them to take. And I'm hopeful that enough women, moderate Republican, independent, and Democratic women will join together to say this is unacceptable, and we will not continue to support elected representatives who are going to make decisions like this.
You mentioned the sonogram bill, which was passed into law and is now, subject of litigation. The thing about the sonogram bill is that it couldn't have passed without the support of three of your Democratic colleagues in the Senate to override the two-thirds rule. Does that frustrate you at all?
I respect that people make decisions from a place that they function from if it's a place of integrity and honesty. My colleagues that voted against that are Catholic. They've been consistent in their belief that abortion should not be a provided opportunity in this country, and I respect that honest disagreement. I wish it were otherwise. And I wish that we'd had more Republicans like Senator Jeff Wentworth who were willing to say, we're not going to go down this path. I certainly think it's the case that on the Republican side of the aisle, most of the people who were voting in favor of that bill weren't doing it from a place of the same sort of integrity that some others voted for it from. And I wish that some had really stood more for what they knew to be the right thing. And honestly, I think if the women had banded together in the Senate, we could have made a difference there. Unfortunately, I think only two of the women in the Senate actually fought that bill out of the six.
Public education, we all know how devastating the cuts have been. You know, right now, Texas is doing better, a lot better, in terms of its tax revenue than it had been, of course, 2 years ago when these cuts were made. Do you have any hope that some of this funding will be restored in 2013?
I wish I could say yes, but of course you're aware that the governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker have asked all of our state agencies to once again advance budgets that demonstrate a 10% cut. It hasn't been quite the directive that it was prior to last legislative session, which demanded that those cuts were going to be made. Instead, it's inviting that framework be put in place in the event that a decision goes that way. My concern is that with the wave of some of the elections that we've seen in the 2010-2012 election cycle, the pressure to continue to move down that path of austerity in a way that I think really threatens to cripple the future of Texas is very present. And we very well may see, and I think the intention behind having the agencies go ahead and write budgets that demonstrate what a 10% cut would look like is so that there's an easy opportunity to advance that idea when the session starts, if there's enough energy behind it. I hope that people across the state of Texas are watching and paying attention to what the majority party is doing in terms of representing them, their families, and future economic opportunity through workforce development here in the state. When we starve public education, we are starving workforce development. And when we starve workforce development, we're starving our economy. And it isn't going to be a long-term benefit for the state at all. It's, as I think Ben Franklin coined the phrase, penny wise, pound foolish. We're heading down a long road of pound foolishness right now.
Let's talk redistricting. You were one of the interveners in the redistricting litigation that is still ongoing. I'm hoping that someday we'll get a ruling from the court in D.C. Talk to me a little bit about what your involvement was in that. What did it mean to be an intervener? What did you actually do in the litigation?
By intervening in the litigation, it gave me an opportunity to be the voice for people back in Senate District 10 who had been impacted by that redistricting. As you, I'm sure, are aware, almost every single African-American precinct in Senate District 10, the urban core of Fort Worth, had been cut from the district and moved and joined in a Senate district that's anchored in Waco and Granbury with a community that they had nothing in common with at all. The same happened for the Latino community on the near north side of Fort Worth's urban core, which was carved out and moved up into the very conservative suburban Denton County district that's represented by SD 12. And the real concern, of course, is not that that means that the current Democratic office holder can't win re-election. The concern is that people in that community who once had the opportunity and the power to come together and have their families represented in the Texas Senate, we're never going to have that chance again. The separation of those populations from each other is incredibly harmful. And what it promises to do is what we've seen happen all over the state. It's why we see people get elected that aren't really representing the interests of real Texas families, when districts are drawn in such a way that narrow ideologies rather than real people hold sway and power in determining the outcome of the election, it does a long-term disservice to representative democracy in the state of Texas, and I felt it was very important to take that stand, and I'm so pleased that we were able to settle and regain the district. It's entirely as it was in 08 once again, and those communities have been rejoined and will once again have an opportunity to exercise their voice in a Senate district election.
And the interesting thing about that to me is that, I mean, what the argument was that District 10 was a coalition district. There isn't a single minority population that has a majority in the district, but together, collectively, as you say, they can exercise their voice and choose a representative, a senator of their choosing. The state, in its lawsuit, has argued that essentially coalition, there's no such thing as a coalition district from a Voting Rights Act point of view, and indeed, you know, the same settlement led to the splitting up of Austin and the dismantling of Congressional District 25. Why do you think it went one way in one district and the other way in another?
I have to, you know, really give a lot of credit to the strategic team that we had in place to make that happen. We had excellent legal counsel, and I think we were able to go to the court and tell a very compelling story about the purposeful discrimination that occurred in the redistricting of Senate District 10. One of the things that it offered, because of how flagrant that dissection of the district was a real visual for the court to observe and really wrap their minds around in terms of how blatant the carving up had been and who the target of that carving had been. And I think we were able to not only demonstrate what the detrimental and devastating impact to the community would be, but we also were able to put together, I think, a very good record of the process that occurred throughout the legislative session that could point to nothing other than a very purposeful discriminatory plan from the outset that excluded public input and the voices of the community that would be impacted by it in a very strategic and purposeful way. And the court seemed to, particularly the D.C. court panel that we had, two Republicans, one Democrat, seemed to find it particularly compelling. And I think that the Attorney General's office understood that that was the case, and it made them more willing to settle in a way that was favorable for us.
Do you think the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, your co-litigants, do you think we ultimately got the best deal we could have out of the settlement? I mean, obviously, you're not going to get the very best because, you know, there's always uncertainty about how a court will rule. But do you think that, as you know, some people thought that, certainly with the congressional and state representative map, that there were some things left on the table? What did you think?
I think that's true. I think there were some things left on the table, and I was disappointed that the intervener groups didn't really stick strongly together. They allowed the state to employ a divide-and-conquer method that essentially meant we didn't get in congressional and the House settlement all that we could have. And I think, you know, in that regard, I guess I was fortunate that my Senate district was the only Senate district that was a part of the litigation, and I was able to make a unilateral decision that didn't rely on all of the intervener parties. We were very fortunate to have LULAC as one of the interveners in our Senate case, and LULAC stuck to our goal from the get-go, and they were true to that all the way through, and they were a large part of why we were successful.
And you alluded to this in the previous question, but there's no question that the the way that Senate District 10 had been drawn by the legislature was to put a target on your back.
Yes.
And I think it's fair to say that your defeat is the Republicans' number one priority in this cycle. I mean, arguably there aren't any other targets for them
yes.
to aim at. How does that make, you know, how do you react to that and how do you deal with it?
You know, I suppose it's a compliment. I suppose it means they feel that the work I've been doing is effective, that it is holding them accountable to the decisions that they're making that aren't taking Texas in the right direction. But on the other hand, of course, I'd prefer not to be the focus of such vitriolic attention. It's just
Dan
part,
Patrick
part
in particular
of it,
likes you. I can tell.
Yes, I'm of course one of his favorite people. No, but seriously, when you're taking on hard issues and you're standing up for what you believe in, unfortunately, that can be the consequence. And I'm really proud that those political consequences haven't driven the presence and the role that I've been playing in the Texas Senate. And I think that's what people really want to see. I think that the consequences of that really are positive and will be positive. I think people back in Senate District 10 want to know that someone's standing up for them, whether they are Republican or Democrat, and I believe that we will see at the ballot box in November that when you do that, it is rewarded and people will return you to your seat.
Okay. And I was earlier in the press room, I mean, as a blogger, blogging has its privileges, and I heard San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro talk about some people who he saw as the future of the party, and you were one of the people he mentioned, and my interpretation of that, I don't want to put words in his mouth since I didn't hear the beginning of the question, my interpretation of that is that, and this is my own personal opinion, that you're someone who I think would be a future, very credible statewide candidate. Do you see that in your future?
Of course, I would be incredibly complimented by an opportunity like that. You know, I don't know when Texas is going to be ready to make a change like that and to bring a different kind of voice to a statewide office here. But I would be honored, of course, if I had an opportunity to play a role in that.
Okay. And, of course, you have to win this election first. So what's sum it up for me in your best your campaign elevator pitch. Why should the people in Senate District 10 vote to reelect you this year?
Because they have a person of honesty and integrity and courage representing them. And I think it's a fairly rare quality in elected officials. And I think that they have someone who's been listening to them in a way that they are seeing in action and that they will reward that by voting for me in the 2012 general election.
All right, Senator Wender Davis, thank you very much
thank
for talking
you.
To me today.